this is what we do. It is the most important part of understanding about life. We can start to be philosophical and think about life, but the most important part about life is not the thinking, but the doing, the action. And the Buddha gave some very deep and profound advice on what to do. And so much so that he called it right doing or right effort. And this thing we call right effort is a very important part of the Buddha's teachings. For those of you who've been here before, you may have heard the Buddha, or heard or read, but the Buddha gave his teachings in the form of a path which leads to enlightenment. And that path he called the Eightfold Path. And one of the factors on the Eightfold Path is right effort, right doing, right action, what we actually do. And this is what I wanted to talk about this evening. I wish to talk about it because it affects all levels of our life, not just the what we may call the spiritual aspect of our life, but also what we do outside in the world. Right action is that which will create harmony, happiness, peace, and eventually enlightenment in our life. And if it's wrong effort, it's something which goes in the opposite direction. Someone asked me just before I came in here, what's the difference between this right and wrong? Because they have read in some books that really there's no difference at all between right and wrong. And that the wise person is someone who is above all right and wrong. But there is such a thing called a right path and a wrong path, just the same way that there is a right side of the road to drive on and a wrong side of the road to drive on. Then you know what happens if you drive on the wrong side of the road. You're going to get into trouble. You're going to get injured. You're going to get suffering. If you drive on the correct side of the road, then you're going to get wherever you want to without any problem. So there is such a thing called the right and the wrong. The right path in Buddhism is that which leads to these marvelous good qualities. I've already mentioned them before: happiness, harmony, peace, eventually enlightenment. Wrong goes in the opposite direction. And you can know from your own experience the difference between right and wrong if it creates problems, arguments, difficulties, suffering, disharmony, then you know it must be a wrong path. If it leads to peace, leads to harmony, leads to happiness, and eventually to full enlightenment, to absolute happiness, then you know it must be the right path. So there is a thing called right, and there is a thing called wrong. And sometimes if we try and waver between both of them, it's that saying which somebody was telling me a few weeks ago, saying that he who tries to walk the middle path, the middle way between these two, gets hit by traffic coming both ways. So you have to really sort of take a stand here on what is right and what is wrong. You don't get anywhere by wavering in between. So there is a thing called right effort, and this is its idea. It leads to happiness, it leads to harmony, it leads to peace, it leads to enlightenment. So what did the Buddha say, like, you know, right effort is? Certainly he didn't sort of say that it was like depending on something outside of you. Effort comes from within. You have to do it. You may have seen the inscription on the statue outside, which is a basic description of the Buddhist path. Not to do any bad, to do that which is good, and to purify the mind. That's the teaching of all the Buddhas. The first part of that, not to do any bad, but to do that which is good, is a teaching of all religions and all wise people. And of course, it makes a lot of sense. But the point is, how do you achieve that? How do you do that? Everyone will teach to do that which is good and not to do any bad, but how do you achieve it? Everyone will say that you should love everybody. You should be compassionate to all beings. But how do you do that when there are cockroaches in your kitchen, when a mosquito is biting you, when there's this person next door who turns on the radio so loud at night so you can't go to sleep? How can you do that? It's all very well to set high goals, but the most important part of a goal is also saying and teaching how you achieve that. And right effort is teaching you how to achieve these goals. And again, the effort has to come within. It can't come from without. There's a story which someone told me a long time ago. I think it's very applicable now, because someone was telling me that there's very heavy floods in the United States at the moment. And this story was about a Christian preacher, one of these fundamentalist blokes in the southern part of the United States, in the Bible Belt, in a time when there was a flood. And the people warned the people in the town a flood was coming, and they asked everyone to evacuate. But would this preacher evacuate? No. He said, "I have faith in the Lord will protect me." And so he wouldn't evacuate. And he stayed by his church, and then the waters lapped around the church. They rose and they rose so high he had to get on his roof. And as he was on his roof, the boat came past to pick up any people marooned in the town. And they came close to the roof and said, "Jump in, we come to save you." He said, "No, no, no, I've got faith in the Lord. The Lord will save me." And the fellow said, "Don't be a fool. The waters are still rising. This is not the end of the rising. They're going to get higher and higher. If you don't jump in, you're going to get drowned." And he said, "No, this is just a test of my faith. The Lord will save me. Go away." The waters carried on rising. So he had to go onto the very chimney on top of his church, his steeple. He was holding on to the top of the steeple when another boat came past. "The last boat," they said, "to pick up any stragglers. Please jump in, there won't be any more boats, and the water's still rising." And he said, "No." He said, "I have faith in the Lord will save me." And no matter what they did, they couldn't get this fellow to jump into the boat. So after a long while, they had to leave him there. And the waters rose even further. And this poor man who was holding on to the television aerial on top of his church, the very last thing, when a helicopter came, they'd been told about this bloke, and a helicopter dropped down the ladder, saying, like, "Grab hold of the ladder, and then we can free you, we can sort of save you." And he shouted up the helicopter, "I have faith in the Lord. The Lord will save me." And they couldn't get him to get hold of the ladder. And what do you think happened? He drowned, yeah. The waters rose, and there was no other helicopters or boats, nothing more to hold on to, so he drowned and died. And when he went up to heaven and saw God, he was very upset. He said, I had faith in you, and you embarrassed me. Look what happened, I died. I had faith in you, and you didn't help at all." And God said, "What do you mean I didn't help? Didn't I send you two boats and a helicopter?" So when you talk about right effort, it's what we have to do ourselves. And that's one of the first things about right effort. It has to come within. Don't go and rely upon God, or the Buddha, or one of the monks. The first teaching about right effort is, if you want to be saved, whatever that is, you have to do it. You have to jump in the boat. You have to jump in the helicopter. If you want to do good, to stop doing bad, you have to do it. If you want to be kind and compassionate, you have to do it. If you want to be peaceful, you can't just sit there and think that somehow peace will come. You have to do it. If you want to be someone who is kind and loving to the people you live with, you have to do it. That's why that third part of what's written outside on that, underneath the statue, that inscription, is by far the most important. Do what is good, to stop doing what is bad, to train your mind. That's how you achieve happiness, harmony, peace, enlightenment, training. Training means it's something we have to do. What we have to do, the Buddha described this very well. He said that what the effort is as follows. There's four parts to it. The first part is called abandonment, the second part is called avoidance, the third part is called developing, and the fourth part is called like maintaining. What we say about like abandoning is that if there's any unskillful things are in your mind or in your life, if there's anything unskillful there, he said this, he said to allows the will to strive, to initiate energy, to grab hold of the mind, and to endeavor to get rid of that which is an unskillful thing in your mind or in your life. To create effort to do something about this. Don't just sit there and wait for it to go, but to do something about it. The second of these right efforts is in future to avoid this thing happening again. To arouse the will, to strive, to initiate effort or energy, to grab hold of the mind and to endeavor that these unskillful things don't arise again, either in your mind, in your life, or in society. And the third of these right efforts is to encourage good things to arise, wholesome states, either in one's mind, in one's life, or in society. And the Buddha said to arouse the will, to strive, to initiate energy, to grab hold of the mind, and to endeavor that these, what we call wholesome good things, arise in the mind, arise in our life, arise in society. And the fourth of these right efforts is to maintain. If there is wholesome, good things in your mind, in your life, in society, don't just take them for granted, but to arouse the will, to strive, to initiate energy, to grab hold of the mind and endeavor that these things would last and will grow even more. These are the four right efforts. And you can see just the beauty of the Buddha's teachings here. First of all, we have to know the difference between what is a good state and a harmful state. What he said, like, it's a very good Pali word. I don't like to use too much the Buddhist language here, but this is a good word to know, kusala. Kusala. It means like good and wholesome. There was very recently that I was having a bit of a problem with some person who was accusing someone very unfairly, and it got to the point I had to ring up a lawyer, a friend of mine who was a Buddhist. And I read out the accusation which this person was saying, and even though he was like a lawyer in Perth, he kept on saying, this is really not kusala, it's not kusala. I don't know if he uses that in the law courts, but it's a marvelous word to use, because much which goes on in the law courts isn't very kusala, isn't very like wholesome, good, useful, fine. This word kusala, it has like a very deep and inner meaning. That which is noble, wholesome, good, conducive to progress on the path to happiness, harmony, peace, enlightenment. This is what we mean by kusala. That which is good in the sense of leading to these things. And it has this opposite word, akusala, not kusala. The kusala and the not kusala. Now we have to know that first of all before we can actually exert effort. Because sometimes we'd be putting effort into the wrong things. We'd be encouraging that which is not wholesome for us, for our life or for society. And of course you can see that much effort and energy in this world is put in places which are not really worthwhile, which isn't conducive to these things, which doesn't create happiness and harmony and peace and enlightenment in the world. people have energy, we put forth effort, why don't we put forth energy and effort where it really counts? Rather than just wasting it on silly things. So that's the first thing we have to know, is the difference between that which is wholesome and that which isn't wholesome. Once we know that, then we have to put forth the effort and energy to abolish that which is unwholesome in our life. What is unwholesome? Examples. Anger, like greed for things which you can never attain, jealousy, fear, guilt. Sometimes the first job I have as a monk teaching Buddhism is actually convincing people that these are unwholesome qualities. Again, sometimes people think it's good to be angry. You know, you can get a bit of a high out of getting angry, can't you? If you get away with it. If you are bigger than the other person. Or if you can intimidate them. Sometimes for people there's a certain joy in really telling someone, you know, what you say they deserve to hear. But the Buddha said these are unwholesome qualities. They don't give rise to harmony. You may get your own way, but it's only out of fear. And it's not something which is going to develop one's relationships in a very positive and good, wholesome way. It may be a stopgap, but in the long term, if we are going to learn to live with in harmony with one another in this world, if we are going to create a decent society, these things are unwholesome. Even more so, we can see they're unwholesome for us, inside our mind. The Buddha kept on saying, if you are angry, if you are jealous, if you are feeling guilty, if you have this greed inside of you, what does it feel like inside? Do we call that peace of mind? Do we call that contentment? Do we call that happiness? If one can look and see, and this is part of meditation, part of what we call mindfulness, looking and seeing what these things are like as experiences, we'll soon find out that these things are indeed unwholesome qualities. They hurt, they're not conducive to our happiness, to our peace, to harmony. They're not going to lead to enlightenment. Inside of us, they are going to lead in the opposite direction. It is a long path. We can see that ourselves if we really look. So these are what we call like unwholesome qualities. So what the Buddha was saying, if these unwholesome qualities arise inside of you, you have to do something about it. You have to see if you can find a way to abolish them. Now the way of abolishing unwholesome qualities needs, again, wisdom. The first thing, we have to abolish them. And the Buddha said, the first thing to do is to arouse the will to abolish these unwholesome qualities. If we don't have the will to do something about it, of course, nothing will ever happen. Anything which is unwholesome in our life, or in our mind, or in society, if we just let it be, leave it alone, nothing's going to happen. It's just going to go on and on and on and on. The first thing, if a person wishes to give up smoking, is have to arouse the will to give up smoking. If we want to get rid of our inner anger in the way we speak to one another, in unwholesome ways, we've got to arouse the will to do something about it. If there's some part of our character which has been causing us problems, if there's some parts of the way we look at our past which gives us problems, we have to do something about it. Arouse the will to change. And then we strive, we initiate energy. Because if we are going to do something about the situation, it's not going to be easy. We have to arouse energy. From will, we get energy. And the Buddha said, we grab hold of the mind. Now, the will and energy is strong enough to change, like, the habits of our mind. Because these are the bad qualities inside of us, are no more than habits. Just ways of reacting to life, which we've got into, which we've done again and again and again, so often it becomes just an automatic habit. Someone calls us an idiot and we get angry at them. It's a learned response which doesn't need to always be that way. There is other ways of dealing with it. So we have will, we have energy, we strive. Now the way we deal with these things, having got those basic ingredients of will and energy and striving, will depend upon our wisdom. Sometimes that wisdom does mean a change in the situation, doing something about it. Sometimes it means just applying just endurance or equanimity. The difference is, if there is something you can do, do it. If there's nothing you can do, then let it be. This is an important part of abolishing or getting rid of unwholesome states. If there's an unwholesome state in the mind, like you're very worried about something, you realize that it's being stupid worrying about this thing, or you're very anxious about something, or you're very depressed about something, these unwholesome states of mind, you have to know whether there's some way of dealing with this at the moment, whether there's an escape, whether there's something you can do or take, some different attitude, and if there is, you give it everything you've got. Energy. Sometimes the way to deal with these things is by what we call substitution. You take an unwholesome state of mind and you put in its place something which is the opposite. If you're very depressed, you deliberately think of those things which you enjoy. You deliberately go to those places where you have had good times before. You go deliberately seeking to put in the place of that hole we call depression, joy and happiness. Substitution. Again, that has to come from will and from energy and from that ability to strive. And one can do that by substitution. If one is angry, one can substitute that with compassion. Only if one has will and energy and wishes to do this. When one is angry, one is seeing the hurt which that person has done to you. If you, instead of thinking of you, you think of them, they must be feeling in a terrible state to have done this to me or to have said this. Why would a person do such a thing? Would they do that if they were happy? Quite often that one can deal with the anger given to you by others in this way, by substituting it with compassion. If someone has hurt you, if you actually can think, contemplate why they did that, you can usually find out that it means that they are hurting inside. They've had a very terrible experience, maybe just that morning, that day, or earlier on in their lives. And you can feel yourself what it must be like to have said such an awful thing, or to have done such a hurtful deed. When you do hurtful deeds, when you say awful things to other people, how do you feel? Why do you do that? Why do you say that? When you know the reason why people express anger or hurtful deeds or hurtful things, when you know that inside yourself, when you can see yourself doing that same thing in the past or in the future, when you can identify with your enemy, when you can put yourself in their mind, then you know compassion. This is what compassion is, isn't it? It's putting yourself in their mind, in their heart, and feeling what they feel, experiencing their pain. That's compassion. And if you can experience the pain which your enemy is feeling, the reason why they are saying those things, doing those things, you have compassion inside of you. And as soon as a moment of compassion arises inside of a person's heart, anger disappears. Like night and day, you cannot have both at the same time. And so one can, by striving, by grabbing hold of the mind, one can change these unwholesome states by substituting. One can change these unwholesome states by contemplating, by finding out the cause of these things, by finding out how it feels, by using what we call just basic human intelligence. People have intelligence, but they direct it at the wrong places, at the wrong times. If there's a problem in one's life, if there's a problem in one's society, then use one's intelligence there. One of the reasons I became a monk was that I went to a good university over in England, and the professors and lecturers who used to get to know there were the famous people in their field at the time. They were extremely well known, and people like Fred Hoyle, you know, who's still well known. And when you get to know these people, you think that these are amazing intelligence. And then you get to find out how they use that intelligence in their life. And these people, I was amazed to find out these people with enormous intelligence, you know, much more intelligence than I have, were getting fed up with their wives, getting into arguments, getting depressed. And even though their intelligence was rewarded with great fame in their field, in the field of human happiness, they were always flunking. They were never passing their exams. And I thought that if people have so much intelligence, what's the point of using that just to find out these great theories in theoretical physics, when at home, just they're having arguments and they couldn't even live with another person? And to me, if one has intelligence, one might as well use it in the area which is most profitable. And the area which is most profitable is in the area or the field of human happiness. If you have intelligence, use it there. Find out the secret of happiness. And so this is another way of overcoming unskillful, unwholesome states of mind. Using one's intelligence, finding out why. Where did this come from? How can I overcome this? And so finding the cause of these things, well, I can overcome them. Sometimes it takes just saying no to these states of mind. Once you know anger very well, you can see it arising in you. And when anger arises in you at the very beginning, that's the time you can say no to it. Once you know depression, you can see when depression starts to arise, and you can say no to it. Once you see greed, you can see greed arising, and say no to it. This evening, as I was in here, coming early from the monastery, I was walking from the office to the monk's quarters around the back there, and I saw on the table out there a pie, which was already had one slice taken out of it, and it smelled very delicious. It's amazing, when you only eat in the morning, when you see food in the afternoon, it seems very delicious. In the morning, it's not so delicious at all. It's only when you can't have it. And it also, it smelled very delicious as I walked past. And as soon as I saw that pie on the table with no one around, I had to say no very quickly. And this is like an example. If you don't know how to say no, you get into all sorts of trouble. Not only do you break your precepts, but you pinch someone else's dinner and you get into awful trouble. Little things can get into big problems when you don't know how to say no at the very beginning. And this saying no is a very important part of being a human being. This is what we call restraint, the ability to say no when you realize it's going to land you in trouble. When you realize it's going to cause problems for yourself, problems for the people you live with, problems with society. It's amazing that all the things which create problems, or many of the things, are very enjoyable. Taking heroin is very enjoyable, so I've been told. It gives you a very good sense of a high. Going out getting drunk at the time is enjoyable. Junk food is very tasty. Many of these things are very pleasurable, but they lead to unhappiness. And if we haven't got a strong mind, if we can't say no, we cannot resist these temptations. The beautiful wife of our best friend, you know, the sort of the strong husband of someone we know. If you can't resist these temptations, you get into trouble. And so the ability to say no is a very, very important thing to train ourselves in. the ability to say no to our desires for the sake of wisdom, for the sake of happiness, for the sake of peace, for the sake of harmony, for the sake of enlightenment. If we haven't got that strength, we'll never get happy, we'll never be in harmony, we'll never know peace, and certainly we'll be far from enlightenment. So the ability to say no is an important way of overcoming unwholesome things in our life, in our mind, and even in society. But it's not only overcoming unwholesome things once they're there. And in fact, once they're there, it becomes difficult to overcome unwholesome things. The best time to overcome unwholesome things is beforehand, avoidance. You become someone who knows how to avoid trouble, problems, and suffering. Okay, if you're sick, the best way to overcome that sickness is to go to the doctor, go to hospital. That's called the first right effort, the effort of abandoning, getting rid of unwholesome things. But everyone knows the best way to cure an illness is to avoid it arising in the first place, eating the right food, exercising, meditating, the marvelous way of overcoming sickness. Really, we should be getting a grant from the health department for saving people from going to hospitals all the time. Anything which is going to avoid problems arising is called the second of the right efforts. It's to avoid problems. I've only known one monk get beaten up, really quite seriously. And I was surprised that how can like a monk sort of get in the situation of being attacked by, you know, these men, and they're really quite badly beaten. Then I found out he was a monk from the, he became a monk in Korea, South Korea, and a very like good meditation teacher up there. And he was back in New Zealand, in the town of Wellington, and that's where he got beaten up. Now, I wonder why it was until I was told that in the town of Wellington, in New Zealand, there is one street which is the red light district. They have the bars, the nightclubs, the brothels. And for one, some reason or other, he was walking down that street about 11:30 in the evening. What do you expect, you know, if one goes to such places? Maybe, you know, you don't expect it, but it's more likely than if you sort of, you know, you're walking past the Buddhist Society in Nolamara at sort of 6 o'clock in the evening on a Friday night. That won't happen to you, I guarantee it. So there is something we call like the right effort of avoidance. Avoiding trouble, avoiding problems. I remember in London as a young man, I used to go down to pubs with my mates. Everybody knew the pubs where you go for a fight. If you really wanted a fight on a Saturday night, the pubs you can go to, and you're guaranteed to have one there. And there are other pubs where you can go just for, you know, a quiet drink, or, you know, to pick up a few, you know, ladies or whatever. You knew where to go. If you really want to get into trouble, you know, you knew where to go. And really, you can use your intelligence. If you want to avoid trouble, you can do. This is called right efforts. You know, sometimes, you know, people, they come and they've got all these problems and troubles. And, you know, you ask what they've been doing. You know, why are you in this situation? And you can just sometimes just see this. What do you expect if you go and do such things? You're bound to get trouble and problems. So there's like this right effort of avoidance. Avoiding problems. Avoiding situations. Avoiding unwholesome states arising in the mind. Avoiding like lust coming up in the mind. If you're a monk, or if you are married to another person, you're committed to them, you have what we call a commitment. But you're a human being. Lust can come up very easily. Once it comes up, you're in trouble. Because lust makes you crazy. Lust makes you forget, you know, what's in your interest. What's going to make you happy? What's good for your children? What's good for the people you're with? And you know just what happens. when a person can't avoid these states of mind. Or when you get angry and say the wrong thing to the person you really love and care for, and you end up getting into all sorts of difficulties. We have to avoid that which is unwholesome for our own happiness. In particular, in our life, in our meditation, if you really want to be happy in meditation, if you want to be peaceful, there are certain states of mind you have to avoid. If you're sitting meditation and watching the breath, you have to avoid other things, other thoughts. The person next to you is coughing. If they've got a cough, well, then they go back home. They shouldn't come in here. They know we're trying to be quiet. Avoid that. It's not going to help you. It's not going to make them stop coughing. So you're just wasting your time. Avoid unwholesome states of mind. Now the third of the right efforts is encouraging good states. Bringing them up. Now this is very important because much of life can be abolishing or avoiding. When there's a bad problem, we want to do something about it. But that's only half of life. We have to encourage that which is good, bring it up. So when we're feeling at ease, when there's no anger inside of us, when there's no problems in our life, that's when we encourage good states to arise. That's when we encourage compassion. That's when we encourage generosity. That's when we encourage like all types of kindness, goodness. We arouse these things when there's no problem at all inside. If you're living with another person and there's no problems in your relationships, be careful. There's dangerous ground there when everything's going well. Because when everything's going well, we become heedless. When everything is going well, we don't put forth effort into arousing good qualities in our relationship, in our life, in the society. When things are going well in the country, we think, okay, we don't need to do anything. That's the time we should be arousing good qualities. That's why if you really want to learn about loving kindness, if you really want to learn about how to love enemies, you can't do it when your enemy's in front of you. You can't do it when the enemy's just attacked you. The only time you can really start to learn how to love your enemies is when they're not there, you're not even thinking about them, but when everything is going really, really well, and you're feeling at ease, at peace, you're sitting at home after Friday night talk, that's when you start to think of your enemy. That's when you can actually start to feel compassion for them. And if you can start to feel compassion for them when you're feeling at ease, when you're not bothered with them, that's when you can start to build up the deposit of kindness when they're not there. And then, having built up that deposit of kindness, of compassion, when the problem is not there, when you do meet them eventually, because of all that training, all of that work, then you can learn how to love them. You can't do this training on the job when they're there. If you have an enemy, someone who's really hurt you, or someone who you find it very hard to forgive, the only way you can learn how to spread compassion to them, when they're not there, when you're feeling at ease and at peace, then bring them up. Then you've got a greater chance, you have a possibility of giving them kindness in your mind. If you can do that again and again and again, the moments when they're not there, when you're at ease, you build up this energy, and when they do come, and you are with them, you have a different attitude. The habit is broken. And kindness comes. If you have a problem with anger or depression, it's good to try when that depression is over. Don't take it for granted. Bring up joy and energy. It's like when you've overcome a sickness and you're well again. You have to encourage health do not help. You can't just think, oh, I don't need to do anything anymore. The sickness is gone. I can go to McDonald's and gorge myself. I can just stay in bed. I don't need to exercise. I don't need to come do meditation. I'm healthy now. That's what happens sometimes. People come to see the monks when they're very in problems and they're sick, you know, because they've had a problem with a divorce or separation or a death or depression or whatever. And they come listen to the talks and then they feel better. They don't come anymore. Then a few years later they come again. In fact, even when you're feeling good, when there's no problem, it's important, right effort is to encourage good states, even when things are going well. This is called right effort. If there's a good state, encourage it. Whether it's kindness, whether it's generosity, whether it's sort of helping another person. Feelings of warmth, feelings of giving, feelings of sharing. These are good qualities which we encourage at every opportunity. You know, you don't just learn compassion just by thinking about it. You learn it by doing it. Sometimes the people think that metta meditation, loving kindness meditation, sitting here and thinking, may all beings be happy. May all beings be well. May all beings be free from suffering. And then after this loving meditation is so high, and you just go out of this temple here, you're just on Morley Drive, someone cuts in front of you, you just pull you, what are you doing that for? Meditation. Loving kindness meditation means when somebody's waiting to turn in front of you, you stop your car or you slow down, you let them come in front. When you're waiting in the queue in the bank and you're in a hurry and someone else is also in a hurry, you let them go first. That's loving kindness. Actions, words. This is what we mean by compassion, doing it. So by encouraging this third light effort, encouraging wholesome states, we do especially by acting, by speaking. Every kind word you say is worth its weight in gold. The Buddha actually said this. He said, you know, one act of compassion is worth thousands and thousands of dollars worth of donations for Buddhist society. I shouldn't say that, but that's what the Buddha said. A lot of us say, I don't need to put any money in the box today, I just have one sort of compassion. That's true. An act of compassion, of kindness, is one of the greatest merits. This is like right action. And the form for these right efforts, I think, is the most important of all. It's when there are good states, one puts, what did Buddha say? He said one arouses will. One strives, one initiates energy, one grabs hold of the mind, and one endeavors to maintain those wholesome states and to make them grow further. This is happiness in the realm, in society. You must not take it for granted. You must strive, exert will, have energy to maintain that which is good. Because things which are good, which are wholesome, have the unnerving habit of changing or disappearing if we don't keep going. You've got a beautiful centre here. If you don't look after it, it's going to disappear. You may have a marvellous relationship with somebody. If you don't look after that relationship, strive, put forth effort. Initiate energy. Grab hold of the mind. Endeavour. That relationship is going to fade away. How often is it that the person falls in love, gets married, and thinks, that's it, I don't have to do anything anymore? Constant effort is required. Constant striving. To maintain that which is wholesome and good. That which is causing you happiness. Constant effort to maintain it. And not just to maintain it, to make it grow. Make that relationship with the person you live with grow. Increase. you can have this right effort to maintain and to make grow is very important, because human beings have the awful tendency of, again, taking things for granted. When things are going well, when we're healthy, when we're happy, when we've got a reasonable amount of money in the bank, we just think, I don't need to do any more. And our happiness slips away from us. Our peace slips. So these are the four right efforts. And they're very, very important in the realm of meditation. If we want to make the mind peaceful inside of us, we have to know those things which are obstacles to peace. When they arise in the mind, we have to do something about it to overcome and to get rid of them. Any disturbance to the peace in meditation, we have to recognize and overcome. The quicker we can do that, the easier it is. The longer they stay in our mind, the more they become habits. Any thinking, dwelling on the past or on the future, thinking about our problems, that can become a habit during our meditation. Don't allow it to become a habit. As soon as something which doesn't belong in the meditation arises, eradicate it, overcome it. The earlier you can do it, the easier it becomes. And to set a guard on the mind to avoid anything which is a disturbance to the meditation. To avoid it even before it arises. The thought might come up, I wonder what's happening in the monastery. Stop. No. It's not the time. What should I talk about after the meditation's finished this evening? Stop. What am I going to do tomorrow? Stop. Avoid all of these things coming up if you want to be peaceful in your meditation. To be able to arouse good qualities in the mind. Happiness, joy, peace. This takes energy to to make grow. Now to actually get energy in the mind, joy, you've got to actually make that come up. You find the means to straighten your back, to make the mind joyful. You may all know that the first teaching of meditation which I got, this very fine monk in Thailand, I've said this many times, he said, what do you do when you first get up in the morning? I said, brush my teeth and wash my face. He said, is there a mirror there? He said, yes. Well, this is what you should do first thing in the morning. Smile at yourself. And I said, sometimes when you first get up in the morning, it's very hard to smile at yourself. And so you know the answer, he said, you've got two fingers, put them on either side of the mouth and push them. That's called right effort. Because that encouraged, like a marvellous state of mind. You see someone in the mirror smiling at your face, smiling at you, even though it was with the aid of two fingers, and you smile back, and they smile back even more, and they smile back even more, and in no time at all you're laughing at yourself in the mirror. A marvellous way to start a day. This is arousing good quality in the mind. Joy, the beginning of a day. You've got to get up anyway. You've got to go to work, or you've got to go, you know, to the work as a monk. You've got to come on a Friday evening, through the weekend, here, whether you like it or not. So enjoy yourself. Make it a wholesome state of mind. You know those awful jobs you've got to do this weekend? Enjoy them. Make fun out of them. That wholesome states of mind. You can just do them with pain or you can do them with fun. It's really up to you. Even in jail, when I used to go to the prisons to go and give talks there, people always used to say to me, the prisoners, you can do your time two ways. You can do it hard, you can do it sweet. It's the same prison, it's the same sentence, it's up to you. And even prisoners knew that. If you're going into a jail, which is very unpleasant, you can still enjoy it. You still make something out of it. Right effort. So in your meditation, to arouse good qualities inside the mind, happiness, joy, peace, they need to be aroused. And the most important of all, once they're there, guard them. If you've got peace in the mind, value it. What happens when you've got peace? You're meditating on the breath. Wow, at last! You've blown it already. You've got peace and you go and bother it by saying, wow. I've said this before, it's like you've got these beautiful wildernesses in the world. And people put souvenir shops there. You've got these marvellous mountains, and what they do, put a restaurant on top. You've got these marvellous, peaceful wildernesses in the world. And you spoil it all. You don't know how to value that which is joyful, that which is peaceful, that which is empty. So this ability to maintain is very important in meditation. If there's peace there, maintain it. That takes a very subtle and strong effort of will. When peace arises, keep it there. And then make it grow. Make peace grow until peace is so strong, so all-encompassing, so profound, that it becomes the peace of enlightenment. That's why the Buddha said that the four right efforts are part of the Eightfold Path which leads to enlightenment. It's part of the path which leads to harmony in this world. It's part of the path which leads to happiness in our lives. We cannot just be like that person on top of the church thinking, ah, God will save me. Or the monks will do some chanting. Right effort is what's needed. And this is how we practice right effort in our life and in our meditation. You know it's right effort when it creates these things. Happiness, harmony, peace, enlightenment. Wrong effort creates the opposite. Creates unwholesome qualities. So once we know the difference between these two, I leave it with you to practice the four right efforts in one's life. And then you will know that last word of the Buddha, to training the mind. This part of Buddhism is a training, a growing. Bit by bit, drop by drop, the training happens until the cup becomes full. And one day the last drop will be going into the cup and you're full, enlightened. So, that's the talk on the four right efforts which one can apply in one's life, in society, and especially in one's inner practice, one's meditation. So please, for Buddha's last words, strive on with diligence. See, sometimes people say that mindfulness is a path of deathless. That's a bad translation. The right translation is heedfulness is the path of the deathless. Appamada amatang padang in Pali. Appamada is explained as practicing the four right efforts. The way the Buddha meant this, practicing the four right efforts is the path to the deathless. So may you all reach the deathless and become enlightened. Thank you. Now, are there any questions or comments about this evening's talk? Yes. Is it the right action to vote for the Liberal Party at the next election? I've been associated because in our newsletter, I went to Melbourne and we had an opening ceremony. I helped out there. And the local federal member there happened to be Peter Costello, who just a few days before that opening ceremony had been elected the deputy leader. And so just for, you know, because of the newsletter was supposed to be encouraging the wholesome quality of fun, I just had a little photograph of myself with Mr. Costello, just so I could put underneath Abbott and Costello. Because I can chuckle away on to the acting abbot of the monastery. But no, one should vote for that which is good and wholesome. I haven't got a clue exactly what the Liberal Party is like. I just thought that was a neat name for a politician. Sorry? I need to... Thank you very much. Is there any other question someone would like to ask? Yeah. Okay, you're saying that some parts of human behavior become what we call like an addiction. An addiction is something which one doesn't put any will into doing, one doesn't choose, one doesn't do it mindfully, it just happens automatically. One can't do anything about it. That's like the nature of an addiction. And much of human behavior, like appears as an addiction, but all addictions in the realm of human behavior can be changed. Which is actually called an addiction, takes enormous effort to change. And the heavier the addiction, the more effort it does take to change. It's part of the human being's responsibility, you know, to apply intelligence to know whether that which we're addicted to is going to be wholesome or not. And certainly the unwholesome addictions are the ones we should be overcoming first of all. That which creates problems for ourselves, and that which creates problems for other people. Those addictions may be to, you know, like substances, alcohol, or drugs. They can also be just the wrong speech, or just, you know, wrong ways of living one's life. One could be addicted to these things, whether it's addicted to gambling, or addicting to arguing, or addicting to gossiping. These sorts of addictions that, first of all, one has to realize is their harmfulness, their akusala. Now, human beings should work with those things, first of all. And to the other addictions, whether it's addiction to being like generous or compassionate, and there are some people who are just so generous, it's actually one of the rules for a monk that if someone is really that generous, we've got to really watch out for them. And it comes to a point sometimes you say, no, I'm not going to allow you to make any donation whatsoever. No, you can't come to the monastery to feed the monks again. You should feed yourself. It is actually one of the rules for a monk. You have to watch out for someone who's being overgenerous. And if it becomes addiction to that which is good and wholesome, again, as what you say is absolutely right, that it can be unwholesome. But first of all, a human being should overcome the addictions to the unwholesome qualities, first of all. Once they've got those out of the way, then one overcomes the addiction, the attachment to the wholesome qualities. And so that one can practice the wholesome qualities not out of an addiction, not out of habit, but out of wisdom. Again, the opposite to an addiction where one has no control at all is the exercise of mindfulness and will. Where mindfulness sees what should be done and the will chooses to do it. Or not to do it if it's unwholesome. But every moment, instead of being like a creature of habit, mindfulness is the opposite of being a creature of habit. One sees what one is doing. So I said here a couple of weeks ago, that do you always come in here and sit in the same place? It's amazing how quickly people forget. Do we all sit in the same place? Why do we sit in the same place? Because we're not mindful at the time. We just do the same thing out of habit, automatic pilot. Mindfulness means we come in here and then we see where do I sit, rather than doing the same old thing the same old way. So mindfulness means you're always there, every moment. And you're not just an automatic, not an automatic response. You're always saying the same thing to that person. Mindfulness keeps the door open. So my answer to your question is that addiction, yes, can be a very bad thing for a human being. And it's, a lot of behavior is an addictive behavior. My answer is all addictive behavior can be broken, can be changed. It takes the effort, these four right efforts. And first of all, one should, in the Buddha's path, is to act on those addictions which are unwholesome, which cause problems. Once those are overcome, then those very fine addictions into generosity or compassion, which is just coming out of like say an addictive habit rather than from wisdom. So one overcomes the addiction rather than the qualities of compassion or generosity. Does that answer your question? No. So maybe it's 10 past now, so we shouldn't really have any more questions in public. If you have another question to ask in private, please come up afterwards and ask that question. So thank you very much for listening to the talk this evening. Before you go, we do have some announcements, which are very, very important, very exciting announcements this evening. So please don't go yet, otherwise you don't know what you might miss. Okay, the first announcement is next week the monastery starts the annual rains retreat. For 3 months of the year, Buddhist monks have to stay in one place, and the time is given over to more intensive periods of meditation or study. The rains retreat for this year begins next weekend. It actually begins on the Saturday evening. The following day, on Sunday, we're celebrating the entry to the rains day. It is one of the traditional ceremony or festivals in Buddhist countries, the beginning of the rains retreat and the end of the rains retreat. And so on Sunday week, the 24th, we're going to have a celebration at the monastery in Serpentine, the entry to the rains day. That celebration is encouraging the wholesome qualities of generosity, compassion, wisdom, encouraging everyone who comes to bring a plate of food which will be shared, or dim sum food which will be shared with the community of monks and people staying at the monastery, and with everyone who visits as well. And afterwards there will be a little ceremony, and there will be some meditation and a talk in the afternoon. The program is in the newsletter, which is available, just recently printed. However, if you get the newsletter by post, please don't take a newsletter from here. Just wait for a day or two till the newsletter comes in the post. So that's this Sunday week. Invite everyone, if you've never been to the monastery before, it's a lovely day to go down there. It's very beautiful this time of year. The grass is lovely and green. The kangaroos are fat. The lake... So they don't jump away so fast, because and the lakes are very full, and the streams are flowing. There's beautiful waterfalls going down the side of the monastery. If you haven't been there, it's a marvelous opportunity to go down there on a day when there's something offered. The monks will be around to chat, to talk, and usually they're not. So this is the one day, like an open day at the monastery. So if you are free on Sunday week, the details of the program are in the newsletter, or the entry to the rains day on the 24th of July.
Thank you, Sajabha. I think you're hiring out to write cover brochures or something. Okay, thank you. I welcome everybody here today, and if it's the first time you've seen, a special welcome to you. It's interesting to see that there's not as many people here tonight as normal, because we have about 40 odd people, I think, who have gone on Venerable Gunaratana's retreat for this 9 days. I have just a couple of announcements. One is to do with the 8 precept days that will be held during the rains retreat. So from Sunday the 31st of July, and it is Sunday during the retreat time. On Sundays here there will be an 8 precept day, which is an opportunity to spend quite a bit of time meditating with other people. They begin at 8:30, there'll be meditation between 8:30 and 10:30, followed by taking the 8 precepts by tape. There'll be a tape playing that chant, sharing some food and walking meditation, and there will be a taped Dharma talk played as well, and the day will finish around 3:30. So please come along and enjoy that time. Also during the retreat, at least from the first weekend, first Friday in August through to the last in September, the monks won't be coming to town, and we've got doing a different program. The copies of the program are at the back of the hall here, but there's two tables at the back there on yellow paper, and also in the reception area. So we'll tell you the things that we're doing. We have a number of different guest speakers, and we have a couple of lay people giving talks, and we have a couple of panel sessions. It's the first time we've tried this, and I think that it will be very interesting and a good opportunity to explore the Dharma ourselves and to ensure that we keep on our practice during that retreat time. Another somewhat different announcement, and this is a request that we've had from a student from Curtin University with some help on the research she's doing for her honours degree. And she's doing some research into children's attitude towards death. And she's asked if parents here who have children who are either between the ages of 8 and 10 or between the ages of 14 and 16 would take a questionnaire and just ask their children some simple questions about their attitude towards death. And was interested in what the different religious backgrounds and their attitudes that are developed within the young people. We have quite a lot of those questionnaires, and we'd really appreciate it if those of you who have children in those age bands could perhaps see me afterwards and take one of those questionnaires home. She's asked me to stress that they are anonymous questionnaires. We're not interested in individual children's responses, but in the general, the overall collation of that information. I hope that you'll be able to help her. Please stay back and join us for a cup of coffee or a cup of tea over at the house. Maybe have a look in the library, meet a few new friends, and pick up some reading. Thank you.
Thank you, Jill. So we can just pay respects to Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha. If you wish to stay, please do.
Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhaṃ Bhagavantaṃ Abhivādin Suvākkhato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammaṃ Namassāmi Supatthipanno Bhagavato Sāvakasangho